So we come and it says, in the long run, global politics are bound to become increasingly uncongenial to the concentration of hegemonic power in the hands of any single state. Hence, America is not only the first as well as the only truly global superpower, but it is also likely to be the very last. And what he says, before you start clapping, is that nations will cease to exist to be folded into a one-world government controlled by corporations. I'm paraphrasing him, but that's the essence. And then in almost the last page of the book, he says, I got to do this in German. Moreover, as America becomes an increasingly multicultural society, it may find it more difficult to fashion a consensus on foreign policy issues, except in the circumstance of a truly massive and widely perceived direct external threat. Oh, it hasn't even begun to smoke yet. Now, here's where I start to scare you. I've been doing a lot of research on this. There's a lot of debate on this. But I'm telling you that the more I research it, the more I believe this to be true. There are people who say, well, the aliens are going to bring us unlimited energy. There are people who say that oil comes from magma. There are people who say there's all these wonderful reserves around the world that, and what I'm finding is, and we just found a little footnote, one of my researchers recently, like 23 pages into the footnotes for the U.S. government estimates, that the estimates of reserves are absolutely not connected to reality. It's the same kind of pro forma accounting that's done with Enron. And I will tell you that one of the reasons that the more I study this, the more I believe it to be true is because what's happening now in the world is happening in a model that behaves exactly as if this were true. This is the Hubbert curve, or an extrapolation, widely recognized, widely accepted throughout the energy industry. You may have a debate with it, but again, I'm going to say that this is the way they're behaving. All oil production, oil is a finite resource. Can we all agree on that? There's only so much on the planet. The planet is a sphere. It's a closed system. Oil takes a long time to make. Can we agree with that? Okay. All oil production always follows a bell curve. When you drill your first well and you hit a gusher, you know, and then so you get so much oil, then you drill more wells and you reach a peak of production over the life of an oil field. And then eventually the oil goes down further. You go into what's called secondary recovery and you got to pump in water. And eventually it takes more energy to pump out a barrel of oil than you get from burning it. And that's when the field is essentially dead. There are new methods, you know, but there's no way to change that. World oil production will peak in the year 2006. Never, ever, ever to be exceeded again. After that, world oil production will diminish. Remember, you're sitting on oil. Remember the fertilizers. Remember everything else we talked about. This is a line right here that shows that roughly around the year 2004-5, and we'll see more in a second, world hydrocarbon consumption per capita will, the lines will cross, meaning that suddenly there's going to be conflict. There's going to be scarcity. But look at the line of population as it increases long after world oil production peaks in 2006. As demand is increasing, oil is becoming scarcer and scarcer. Remember that electricity, most of it comes from natural gas, which is the Siamese twin of oil. Plastics, fertilizer, jet fuel, car fuel, all comes from oil. This is inevitable. This is going to happen. And if you go a little bit further, we have another chart here that shows world oil production will peak in 2006, but the oil fields in the Middle Eastern countries, the members of OPEC, will peak last. In other words, it's inevitable that we're going to run out, but whoever runs out last wins the game. The axis of evil. Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. Dale Allen Pfeiffer, my editor for Energy, who has written a great two-part series in From the Wilderness on the website, I talked to him today, and he said, you know, I just found a report that said that they think there's oil on the Korean Peninsula. But following this model, This war that Dick Cheney says will not end in our lifetime starts to begin to make sense, doesn't it? Because the strategy will be, we have some reserves in ANWR, the Alaskan, the Arctic National Wildlife Animal Refuge, but the United States will use its resources last by going around the world and controlling the rest of the world's oil resources, because the scientific research says that when you get to a point where there's 11 billion people, there's going to be maybe 5, 6, 7 billion too many people on the planet. And for the first time, although I've been seeing some evidence for years, I am beginning to suspect that these fools might have made a decision. Well, it's not the problem that there's too little oil. There's just too many people. But notice OPEC peaks last. World peak, 2006. We should start to see very serious signs of it sometime in the next year or two. But once the peak. Now we're going to move into September 11th. Now you have the context. The historical, the political, the economic drug context for what was happening. Now, if you are the district attorneys, I'm going to make my case that the U.S. government had complete foreknowledge of the attacks, was complicit in the attacks, and aided and abetted the attacks. And you will tell me when I'm done whether I've made the case. But let's look at some of the issues about advance warning. And I do this because there's a lot of people on the far right who say the Israeli Mossad did it. No, they didn't. Israeli Mossad is, you know, they do a lot of dirty things, but Israel didn't do this. They might have been a small subcontractor, but I see more evidence that they were trying to tell people that it was coming. They tried to warn the U.S. This is one story from 16-9, which means September 16th, it's European format. Israeli security issued urgent warnings of large-scale terrorist attacks. That's just one of the first warnings. But I happened to pick this up. I did a little research on the tenants of the World Trade Center. The Zim Israeli-American Shipping Company moved out of the World Trade Center on September 5th to Norfolk, Virginia, and it broke its lease to do it. Somebody knew. Somebody cared enough to get their people out of it. Now, in that context, you wonder why, this is a little bit out of order, Afghanistan, you know that the U.S. State Department has a list of nations that states that sponsor terrorism, right? How come Afghanistan was never once listed as a state that sponsored terrorism? Not once, ever. Well, this is from the Washington Post, and if you read the second page of the story, what you see is that the reason why is because UNICAL hired a former State Department guy by the name of Henry Kissinger to keep Afghanistan off the list of terrorist sponsoring nations, including a guy named U.S. Ambassador John Maresca. The funny thing was that John Maresca was a vice president of UNICAL. Washington Post. Had to get the pipeline. We look a little further here. Testimony before the House International Relations Committee in 1998, John J. Maresca, and he says, he's talking about the pipeline, the only other possible route option is across Afghanistan, which has its own unique challenges. We have made it clear the construction of our proposed pipeline cannot begin until a recognized government is in place that has the confidence of governments, lenders, and our company. Cannot begin construction until an internationally recognized Afghanistan government is in place. Okay, so UNICAL saying, by the way, during this period, all the majors had poured billions of dollars bribing their way into Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan, all the major oil fields. They couldn't get their money out. No pipeline. Couldn't go north, Russia, couldn't go west, Iran, couldn't go east, China. Then we see, and you love this, this came out November 4th, 2001, the Chinese National Offshore Oil Company, the largest oil company in China, picks Henry Kissinger to head its foreign advisory board. Henry Kissinger's on both ends of the pipeline. Isn't that wonderful?
Well, I think this is in the best interest of all the people, especially me.
Here's proof, by the way, from ABC News, the UN, DEA. They put people on the ground in Afghanistan confirming that the Taliban burned the opium crop. There was no opium in the ground, period, in February 2001. This is a little bit later, but it's totally confirmed. You remember Tony Blair after September 11th saying, We shall bomb the poppy fields. There were no poppy fields. The planting is in November, and isn't it interesting that we occupied the country just in time to plant a fresh opium crop? And the harvest is in June or July. Just before I got on the plane to come up here, and I've been writing it since day one, you mark my words, this will be the summer of hell for heroin. The Times of London reported just a couple of days ago that they're predicting a crop of 4,500 metric tons of raw opium, the largest in history out of Afghanistan, this summer. Got to get that money in the bank, you know? Markets are in trouble. Now, we're going to get to the heart of the presentation, and we're getting down to the end here, but this is where I want you to pay attention. By the way, people say that the mainstream media doesn't pay attention to us. Yes, they do. We have seen it happen. The stories I wrote on Arthur Anderson prompted results out of Congress. They lost their FBI contract. We've seen other clear indications that they're watching. But one of the biggest compliments I had, this is being circulated all over the world right now. It's going to be published in several books. I wrote this timeline of events, and I titled it, "Oh, Lucy, you got a lot of explaining to do." And I have a standing $1,000 offer to anyone who can show that any source that I cite in this timeline is not authentic or I have quoted it inaccurately. Nobody's been able to make the claim since November. But I'm watching TV last week, and CNN has a senior editor from Newsweek talking about Enron. And he says, "Oh, Lucy, you got a lot of explaining to do," talking about Enron. That's how you get the little signs that they're watching. But now, I want you to put on your most skeptical hats. Here it comes. Here's the case. You're the jury. 1991 through 1997, major U.S. oil companies, including ExxonMobil, Texaco, Unocal, BP, Amoco, and Shell, directly invest $3 billion in cash, bribing the heads of state. That's illegal, by the way. There are two federal grand juries sitting now in Washington and New York City, looking at violations of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. They bribed the heads of state in Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, to secure equity rights in the huge oil reserves in these regions. The oil companies further commit to future direct investment in Kazakhstan of $35 billion cash. Remember the power of cash as opposed to, if you're taking that cash, there's a lot that you can't do. That's for almost a decade. They couldn't get their money out. By the way, do you know who sat on the Kazakh government's oil advisory board during all of those years? Dick Cheney. Do you wonder why he's not disclosing the records of his energy task force? So they pump all this money in and they bribe from 91 through 97. They can't get the oil out. The Taliban's saying no. They're afraid that bin Laden will blow up the pipelines. And bin Laden's pretty wise guy, but he's been created by the U.S. government, by the way. We haven't gone into the long history of financial involvement between the Bush and bin Laden family, which is very well documented on my website, going back to 1976. Just parenthetically, no, it's on here. Good. We'll just go here. The source, by the way, was testimony for the House International Relations Committee and a wonderful article by Cy Hirsch in The New Yorker from last June. Seymour Hirsch. Pretty good journalist. December 4th, 1997, representatives of the Taliban are invited guests to the Texas headquarters of Unocal. Let's barbecue some lamb. Come on down. To negotiate their support for the pipeline. Subsequent reports will indicate that the negotiations failed allegedly because the Taliban wanted too much money. Source, the British Broadcasting Company, December 4th, 1997. February 12th, 1998. Unocal Vice President John Maresca, later to become Special Ambassador to Afghanistan, testifies that you got to throw out the Taliban or we can't build the pipeline. My source, the Congressional Record. 1998, the CIA ignores warnings from case officer Robert Baer that Saudi Arabia was harboring an al-Qaeda cell led by two terrorists. A more detailed list of known terrorists is offered to Saudi intelligence in August 2001 and is refused. Financial Times of London, 1201, the book See No Evil. 1998 and 2000, former President George Herbert Walker Bush travels to Saudi Arabia on behalf of the privately owned Carlyle Group, the 11th largest defense contractor in the United States. While there, he meets privately with the Saudi royal family and with the Bin Laden family. Personally meets with them. They're major investors in the Carlyle Group. The Carlyle Group is a privately held corporation, meaning it does not have to report to the Securities and Exchange Commission who owns it, how it makes its money, how it trades its shares. Privately owned. Yet it buys all kinds of defense contractors, including some that make vaccines, by the way. So the Bush family's in bed with the Bin Laden family. The source, by the way, is the Wall Street Journal story of September 27, 2001, also my little newsletter from the wilderness, which is there, but you can rely on the Wall Street Journal. January 2001, the Bush administration orders the FBI and intelligence agencies to back off investigations involving the Bin Laden family, including two of Osama's cousins, Abdullah and Omar, who are living in Falls Church, Virginia. Now, how many people know where Falls Church, Virginia is? I was born in D.C. Falls Church, Virginia is right next to the CIA's headquarters in Langley. I have a cousin who lives in Falls Church. You can spit over his fence, and you spit over the fence, you're spitting onto CIA property. I did more than spit, okay? So we have a direct order to back off investigations of these two relatives who are known connected to a terrorist group, WAMI, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, and a journalist by the name of Greg Palast, American journalist writing for BBC, breaks the story. Not only does he break the story, he produces an FBI 199 National Security Report, which he shows on television from the complaints of the FBI agents saying the Bush administration told us to leave these guys alone, they're terrorists. And he produced the FBI report. It's still up on the website, I think. The Guardian did it. The Telegraph did it. Now, Greg Palast has taken some pretty decent shots at me lately without mentioning my name because he says that the government didn't have foreknowledge. But remember, he writes for an entity that's owned by the British government. You know, some people, you know, I salute him for the work that he's done. And I will just stop there. I'm making my case now. He's just added to it. Okay, so we know now that the Bush administration has ordered FBI to drop off. But on February 13th, UPI terrorism correspondent Richard Sale reports on an ongoing criminal case in U.S. District Court in Manhattan. It's against followers of Osama bin Laden. And what he writes is that in the case, the National Security Agency presents evidence that they had broken all of Osama bin Laden's encrypted communications. They were reading all of his codes. They knew every phone conversation. Now, if you assume, which is reasonable, standard operating procedure, once you know that your codes are broken, you change codes, right? But how does the United States government then maintain that the planning for the World Trade Center attacks took 4 years? The NSA testimony in this trial said they were reading Osama bin Laden's encrypted communications up to about the year 2000. In court, UPI reported it. In May 2001, Secretary of State Colin Powell gives $43 million to the Taliban. What? Because supposedly the poor farmers were starving because of they were poor because they didn't have any opium and there was a drought and they were hungry. So he gives $43 million, not direct food aid, he just gives the cash to the Taliban. Remember before Desert Storm and Saddam invaded Kuwait, President Bush the Elder sent Ambassador April Glaspie to go see Saddam Hussein with a letter saying, hey, we know you're having problems with your neighbors, but it's listen, you know, we're just from Texas and we don't really want to get involved in your neighborhood disputes. Wink. And the next thing you know, Saddam invaded Kuwait. The wink and the nod. Okay, $43 million. To the Taliban. May 2001, Deputy Secretary of State, one of my favorite people in the whole world, Richard Armitage, former Navy SEAL, bench pressed about 400 pounds, used to love to go on kill missions in Laos and Cambodia, loved to get wet, as they say in the trade. A drug smuggler all of his adult life from Southeast Asia to Iran-Contra, was convicted, was denied appointments to Secretary of Defense under Ronald Reagan, He is an evil man, and he is our Deputy Secretary of State right now. Colin Powell called him in the Washington Times in 1995, my white son.